You know, it's the name that the Bible tells us the day is going to come when every knee is going to bow before Jesus Christ, before that name. How blessed we are if we learn to bow to Him in this life. So that when that day comes, I just had to think of this last song. It was a beautiful song we sang. I had to think what the Bible says. As I tried to find it real quick, but I couldn't. Back to find it says that we groan within ourselves to wit the redemption of the body. You know, as we go through the struggles, the testings, the trials of life, there's times we just come to the point where we just, Lord, can't we just go home? Our key verse for tonight, as far as fathers, just want to share this. Don't think that I have arrived, that I have attained. But over the years, I've learned a few things. At least I think I have. And there's something that we learn in the Bible. You know, there's a lot of people in the Bible, a lot of patriarchs, and old, especially the Old Testament, we read a lot about the stories about people's lives. I enjoy those stories. The Apostle Paul tells us that these things are written for our example and for our learning. And as we preach, you know, sometimes we don't necessarily like to preach about ourselves or we don't like to expose ourselves. But this weekend we're just brothers together. And I'm going to do some exposing of myself. There's things I think that I've learned that can maybe be a blessing. I have a burden. I have a burden for our young families. We have quite a few young families at home. And I tell our young brothers, I tell them the best gift that you can give your children is to take care of all the issues in your own life. And we'll be touching some of those issues as we go through this weekend. But my key verse for this evening is, except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. And I believe the Lord has called us as fathers to build a house. And unless the Lord builds our homes, unless the Lord works in us as fathers' lives, we labor in vain. And we see that around us. We see a lot of homes that are in chaos, a lot of homes that desperately lack. So except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. So I'm going to turn to 1 Corinthians 3. We're going to start out with 1 Corinthians 3, verse 9. Here we read that, for we are laborers together with God. Ye are God's husbandry, ye are God's building. According to the grace of God, which is given unto me as a wise master builder, I laid the foundation, another buildeth thereon, but let every man take heed how he buildeth thereupon. For other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if any man build upon this foundation gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble, every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it. Because it shall be revealed by fire, and the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is. If any man's work abide, which he hath built thereupon, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so as by fire. So we'll go back up to our first verse there, in, verse 9. For we are laborers together with God. I'd like to dwell a little bit on that verse. And as fathers, we are laborers together with God. We labor with Him, and God has a plan. God has an order. If we think about labor, a laborer is companion in labor. For example, we have a carpenter crew. I imagine we have some carpenters in our presence here tonight. And one of you, just like Steve, for example, here, he's that head carpenter. He knows all about it, and he has four workers. Well, those workers are laborers together with him. He's the boss. He's the foreman. He's going ahead, and the others follow his direction, follow his instructions. That's basically what's happening with God. God has a building he wants to build, and we are laboring together with him. He has a plan. He has a blueprint. He has some formulas for us to follow. And if we don't follow that formula, it's not going to come out right. And so we are laboring together with God. And then to me, that's a very sobering thing to think about, that God, he's a holy God. He's a powerful God. He's in heaven. And he wants us to build that, and we are laboring together with him. we think about a building. Let's just imagine that our homes are like a building. God wants us to build according to his formula. And it says here, according to the grace of God, which is given unto me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation. Paul laid the foundation of this building he's talking about here. Another buildeth thereupon. But let every man take heed how he buildeth thereupon. For other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is the chief cornerstone of the foundation that Paul is talking about here. When I was reading about this, think about a foundation. You don't build a house on just a flat surface. You dig a footer. Depending on how it is, you need to put some rebar in there, depending maybe what the codes are and so forth. Put some rebar in there. You pour a concrete footer, and then you build on that. That's a solid foundation that you build on. The Word of God is that solid foundation. And Paul, as he laid the foundation, he squared everything off with Jesus Christ, the teachings of Jesus Christ. And I remember here some years ago, I don't remember which year it was, over in Pakistan they had that terrible earthquake that killed about 80,000 people. Homes were just destroyed. And the reason they were is because they used inferior material to build their houses, to build their schools. they had several multi-story building schools that just simply collapsed when the earthquake hit. The main reason was because their concrete was not strong enough. They had too much weight for the strength of the bottom walls and so forth. So this thing crumbled. And so it's just an example of they were, as far as their foundation may have been okay, but how they built upon that foundation was faulty. And then we discovered Cam was over there, and they had those nationals. They would pour footers for the houses that they were going to build. And some of those footers were so far off square. They didn't know, those nationals up the mountains, they didn't know how to square up, how to square those footers. When we wanted to square the houses, maybe if the footer was this was wide, but the edge of the building, edge of the house was clear out on this side here and way on over here in order to get this thing square. But it's important. It's very important that we have that as we build upon this foundation, that it is square, and that everything, as we build upon the foundation, that we build on this according to the word of God. one thing that I notice, that our children are not ours. They're our children. We call them our children. But the Bible tells us in Psalm 127:3, "Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward." The fruit of the womb is the Father's reward, but it's a heritage. It's something given to us by God. Our children are not our own. A heritage is something that we haven't earned it, really. And in the inheritance, I think you all know what inheritance is, something that we received from our parents, but we did not earn it. It's something given to us. That's how our children are. And they've been given to us for a period of time to instruct them, to bring them up, like it says in the New Testament, in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And once they come of accountability, age of accountability, they choose to serve God again. We give them back to God, and they're actually God's. They're actually God's. But the Bible tells us that the soul goes back to God who gave it. So our children are not our own. In Ezekiel 18:4, as God says, all souls are mine. In Psalms, in Romans, Paul writes, whether we live, therefore, or die, we are the Lord's. So I think that's something that we need to keep in mind, that our children are not our own. As fathers, we have a responsibility to bring those and direct those children back to God, because they're actually His. It's a heritage. It's our children. He has loaned them to us for a period of time to instruct them, to teach them, to guide them, to train them, and nurture them in the fear of the Lord. The scripture that says, train up a child in the way he should go, and he who is old, he will not depart from it. So it is our responsibility to do that, to be stewards over God's heritage. In 1 Corinthians 4:2, moreover, it is required in a steward that a man be found faithful. What I'm trying to do is just lay some groundwork of what our responsibility is as fathers. A steward is someone that, say for example, a rich man has a big mansion. He has someone to oversee that. And he takes care of the groundwork. He keeps the weeds trimmed. He keeps the grass mowed. He keeps the buildings in good shape. He's responsible to take care of someone else's property. So that's really how we as parents find ourselves. We have a responsibility to take care of God's property, which is our children, and that we build homes that are sustainable, homes where love reigns, where there's peace, where there's contentment, where there are good relationships and so forth. And this is—it's a challenge. This is a challenge to do that. Our homes are the estate of God. Our wives are a gift to us to help and work alongside us. Our children are God's, and we have inherited them from Him to watch over, guide, direct, and point them back to Him, so that their souls may be saved in the day of Christ's return. We are co-laborers together with God. Also, stewards of God's building, which in this situation, what we're talking about tonight is our home. Our homes are God's building. We are stewards. We are co-laborers together with God to accomplish His purpose that He has for us in our homes. Our stewardship is a critical responsibility. You know, we have our children. I've read this already. A child's character by the age of five, a child's character is formed. After that, after the age of five, that character basically goes with him through life. And if that character is not, if a child's will is not broken by the age of five, he's going to struggle submitting to authority after that. It's not that God can't come. He can be converted to God. His heart changes. He desires to be under authority, but he's going to struggle with it more than a child where his will is broken and he's submissive. How many parents here have five children? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, about eight fathers here that have five children. If your five children grow up and they all marry, they have five children. And those five children grow up and they marry, they have five children. We're just keeping it with five children per generation.
In 10 generations, I'm not exactly sure how many years that would be. 10 generations. Well, I don't know exactly how many years a generation is considered. But in 10 generations, you end up with 9,756,625 people. So that's just from one set of parents. So in 10 generations, any one of you that has five children, your five children marry, and they have five and five and five and five. As that expands, in 10 generations, you have over 9 million people. Do we realize, do we comprehend the responsibility that we have as fathers to bring up our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord in such a way that the faith and what God desires goes on from generation to generation to generation? It is sad. We had a reunion just this summer. We had a reunion on my mother's side, which is the Slaybaugh side. My relations are in Napanee, Indiana. That's where I was born, Napanee, Indiana. That's where my parents grew up. And we had a reunion. Now, it's my mom, and it's me. I'm second generation. But my mom comes from a family of 12 children. The six youngest all went to the world. So quite a few of my first cousins, divorced, remarried, there's no Christianity there hardly. In this reunion, we visited, my wife and I visited with one of my cousins, one of my cousin's daughter. And she had a desire. She had a longing to know more about God, so forth. We gave them our phone number where she could call in to our messages. And I know she knows she did some. I don't know exactly where she's going. But what I'm saying is that in just three generations, there's a whole slew of people that are without God. They're without God. Divorced, remarried, children out of wedlock, stuff like that. And so it's just a grave responsibility. So if that generation goes on and there's 10 generations, all of a sudden we have millions of people that are without God. It's an awesome responsibility we as fathers have to teach and raise our children. I'm just going to say this again, that if you as fathers, if there's issues in your life, for example, if you're often frustrated, you often feel frustrated just with things in life and the difficulties, and I'm going to say this while I think of it, that is, don't take on too much responsibility, too much debt, to where it bogs you down, where your focus is you just got to work and make these payments. And you miss your children. You don't have the time to spend with the children. I'm a farm at heart. That's really what I love to do. Dairy farming in particular. I worked with a dairy farmer for a year and a half, milked 150 cows, then we had our own dairy farm, so forth. That's really what I desire to do is farming. But when we moved to Worthington, we had a farm there. And it just seemed like we just couldn't make a good go of it in farming. So we started the pallet shop. So we had the pallet shop, we had the farm. But every summer, these two came into conflict. The pallet shop was our income, was our bread and butter, but we still had the farm. And it ended up that we were actually, well, we farmed with horses. So we farmed to feed the horses, so we had horses to farm. Okay, it was a dead-end street. But it created frustration. It created struggles. And we were trying to do both of them. But we'd been a lot better off right in the beginning when we started the pallet shop, rent out the farm, just forget about farming, put it on the shelf. We were too busy. We were too occupied. It created too much frustration. I'm just sharing that. Take inventory. If there's frustration in your life, if there's any anger, if you sense that you're struggling with forgiving people, or maybe there's some moral issue that you're struggling with, or any given struggle like that, take care of those issues, because it's going to hinder you in your relationship with the children. Fear is another one. We'll touch that one a little bit later. An angry father produces bitter children. When a father has inconsistent standards, his children will end up despising him. I'm going to take an example of King David. King David was a man after the heart of God. And these things can happen to fathers that have their hearts turned towards God, and they really desire to serve God. But King David, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about his life, but it ended up that his son Absalom and his son Adonijah both despised their father to the point that they tried to take the kingdom away from him. Both of them did that. It was because David had some inconsistency in his life. There were some issues in David's life. I believe he repented from them, especially with that killing Uriah and Bathsheba there. He repented from that. But it seemed like the issue was not properly taken care of where he could relate to his sons in a way that was productive. And his sons both ended up despising him. Eli in the Old Testament. Eli's sons were wicked sons. Says that they took advantage of the offerings. They were immoral men. Eli rebuked them, but he did nothing to restrain them. Eli should have removed them from office. He should have. He told his son, this is not right. What you're doing? But he did not. It did not. Bible says he did. He did not restrain them. I believe Eli also lived an inconsistent life, because God says to Eli through Samuel, says, "Wherefore kick ye at my sacrifice and at my offering, and honorest thy sons above me, to make yourselves fat with the chiefest of all the offerings of Israel, my people." Eli was overweight. According to the scriptures, he was overweight. He was fat. His sons were taking advantage of the offerings and taking meat that they were not supposed to take. And Eli benefited from that. Eli made himself fat with those offerings that his sons cheated from. He told his sons, it's not right, but he himself took advantage of it. That's inconsistency. And if we do that, our sons will end up despising us. We need to have consistency. When children can't please their father, his children become frustrated and rejected. I just remember, when I was a young boy, I was probably 13, 14, something like that. And I was helping this family build a house. This father was kind of an angry, forceful father. And I remember this friend of mine and I were back in a certain room, and we just kind of sat there and we were talking. You know, we should have been working. And we were there talking. All of a sudden, the father came back there. Says, "What are you boys doing? Get to work. You're supposed to be back here working." Just real angry like that. Turned around and laughed. My friend was embarrassed. I was afraid. My friend was embarrassed. My friend told me later, it was not just this incident. My friend told me later, he says, "I'm not sure I want to get married. If this is the way that marriage is, this is the way families go, I'm not sure that I want to get married." He did then. But just an example of a father, an angry, upset father creates frustration for his children. And if children become frustrated, they become discouraged. If children become discouraged, they lose heart. And it's just not right. Now Samuel, the Bible tells us that the prophet Samuel was a very godly man. It says that none of his words fell on the ground. But his sons didn't turn out well either. His sons took bribes. The Bible doesn't say that they were immoral, but they took bribes and they perverted judgment. The reason they perverted judgment was, I believe, was because that maybe there was a discrepancy between two. And the son, say for example, I'll take Stephen and Timothy here, that I'm the judge, like Samuel's sons were, and I know, that Timothy's taking advantage of Stephen. But Timothy gives me a bribe under the table. So I make the judgment in favor of Timothy. That's perverting judgment. And that's what Samuel's sons were doing. Now what happened? What happened that Samuel, his Bible says that none of his words fell on the ground, but his sons perverted judgment, they took bribes. What happened? I think there's a clue. The Bible tells us that Samuel went around in circuit from town to town to town to town and came back home again. It almost appears like, doesn't really say this, but almost appears like that it took him a year to make that round. I think the sons grew up. They had an absent father. Now Samuel had these responsibilities. And someone had to do that, minister to God's people. But maybe if Samuel would have asked the Lord, like Moses did, he said, "This is too much for me." Then the Lord said, "Choose 70 men, and I will put my spirit upon them. They can help you." Maybe Samuel would have done that. He could have spent more time at home. So my point in bringing this out is, you need to spend enough time with your family, with your children, so that it just seems like a father's presence. A loving father's presence brings stability to the home. Somehow stability lacked. Security lacked in those children and those boys, and they grew up. It was because of that that the Israelites finally demanded a king. And so don't be absent at that absent father. Spend enough time with your children that you know that they're going the right direction. When a father does not admit his wrong to his children, his children will lose confidence in his leadership. Now here again, there's an example of a father. I'll leave the names out of this, but there's a father moved from one community to another. And in his former community, he was struggling with the ministry there, and he just struggled with the church. He moved to another community. And he decided, when he made that move, he decided, "I'm going to go to that community, and I'm going to support no matter what." Okay, the day came when he was ordained in that community. And things came up that decisions were made that he knew it would have been better a different way. He knew some of the decisions that were made were wrong decisions. But he defended that so strongly, and his sons knew. His sons knew that it was wrong. But he defended it, and defended it, and defended it. Till the sons lost confidence in his leadership. It would have been a lot better if he would have sat down with his sons and said, "You know what, sons? This is wrong. I know that it would be better to do it this way. In the situation, I'm not sure how to do it differently. I don't really support it as such. But under the situation, it's not wrong to submit. It's not sin to submit." What I'm trying to bring out, it would have been a lot better And the sons actually told us, the sons knew how the father felt. The sons knew that the father agreed with them. But he didn't openly do that. He didn't openly sit down and talk with them. And so, so in a situation like that, it's a lot better just be open. Just talk about it. And if it's a situation where you just can't go on like that, do something different. But don't defend a wrong when you know it's wrong, and you know your children don't know it's wrong. Don't just defend that. So we're going to talk about some weak fathers. We already talked about Eli. Eli was a weak father. He had rebuked his sons, but he had not restrained them. Now, if we come to David, we talked about Adonijah and Absalom. And Adonijah was a very handsome boy, according to the scriptures. He was a handsome boy, but the Bible tells us that David never displeased Adonijah by saying, why doest thou thus? He never held him accountable for his wrong or for his wrong actions. Son, what's happening? What's happening here? Sitting down and explaining to the son this is wrong, what you're doing is wrong, he never held him accountable. Adonijah just grew up and eventually tried to usurp the throne. Another weak father that we have is Lot. You remember when Abraham and Lot, when they separated? Lot chose Jordan. It says here that it was a well-watered plain, fertile fields. It says it looked like the garden of the Lord. It was a very prosperous area. Lot lifted up his eyes and looked towards Sodom. Okay? He pitched his tent towards Sodom. Later he moved into Sodom. Later he sat in the gate of Sodom. When the time came that the angels came to warn Lot what was going to happen to Sodom and the surrounding cities, Lot went out to his sons-in-laws, "Hey, God is going to destroy this city. We need to get out." They laughed at him. They mocked him. He had lost all influence of his sons-in-law. So that's not a very good place to be. I'm going to turn to two verses in Joshua. Now we're going to look at some strong fathers, some devout fathers that were zealous for God. Maybe we can learn some from these fathers. Let me see. Joshua 24. Verse 14. Here Joshua is talking to the children of Israel just before he dies. He says, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Here is a divine father, a father that has made up his mind that we're going to serve the Lord. Me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. But there were certain things he had to do. It says he admonishes the children of Israel, and he says, put away the gods. Put away things that hinder. Things that create a struggle in your home. Things that hinder you from moving forward. For example, in our situation, just get rid of it before. or rendering it out. Get rid of whatever is hindering you from pressing in and having time with the children in the evening, maybe going on hikes, maybe doing this or that, instilling them with the fear of God. Put away everything that hinders that, and let's serve God. Let's move forward with that. another character that I'm really blessed with is Abraham. We're going to look at the effect, at the influence that Abraham had on his family. This is in Genesis 18, verse 17. Now, Abraham, God is talking with Abraham, and he's telling Abraham that he's going to go down to Sodom, and that this evil cry has come up to heaven. He's going to go see, is it actually the way it sounds? And this is God talking to Abraham. And the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him." Does God know us in that way? If God would come to us, if we'd been in Abraham's position, and God would come to us, would he have that confidence? Would he have that confidence in us as fathers, that I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, and the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him? I believe it's a petition that we should, as fathers, that we should pray and ask the Lord that he would enable us or strengthen us, or that we could have the faith. We have such a walk of life, if he would have this confidence in us. I believe we should. this is the extent of Abraham's influence that he had on his household. In Genesis 17, God gave Abraham the sign of circumcision. Okay, Abraham tells us in verse 23 of Genesis 17, it says, "In the selfsame day that God told Abraham to circumcise, he did it." He didn't procrastinate. It says, "Every male in his household." Abraham had 360 men that he took to help rescue Lot from when Lot was taken captive. Abraham had such a tremendous influence on his household. All 360 men of those men yielded to that command. Can you imagine? This was brand new, something that had never happened before. It was a command of God that all of those men yielded to Abraham, their Lord, their earthly Lord. He had such an influence on them when he told them that God told me to do this, that they yielded, they submitted. Can we imagine the influence that he had on his household? What is our in influence? That's the challenge. That's the challenge for us. Our homes need to be places of protection. The Bible tells us that evil communications corrupt good manners. I believe we should watch our reading material. I know of a situation where there's certain father. I don't know if you know anything about the Armstrong religion, what they call Armstrong. They mean a certain person has last name. I'm not exactly sure. I don't know much about it, but I know it's a false religion. And this father had an Armstrong book in his home. He kept it hidden in his closet because he didn't want his children to read it. But he felt he wanted to know more about the Armstrong religion so he could refute it. But unknown to him, one of his sons found the book and read it and joined the Armstrong religion. He would have been much better off reading the truth of God's word and getting about that book. So I'm just, That is just an example of the power that reading material has.
So I would strongly encourage you to make sure that your reading material is good reading material. Because we are heavily influenced by the things that we read. Romance books. Books that portray a false or an exploited view of love, and it's not a reality. Not a reality. I believe we should read books that are real, that are reality. So I just encourage you, make sure that your home is the reading material that your children have, that reading material is sound, and it's going to build godly character. Now, I've been impressed. If we go to the New Testament, some of the examples that we have, for example, the jailer. When Paul and Silas were in jail, and you know that story, the earthquake and all that, you know that story. But the jailer was converted. And it says, and all his house. How is that possible that the jailer, this was new, this is brand new, they had never heard about Jesus. But him and all his house, they were converted. And in Acts 16:15, we read of Lydia. And it says, and all her house. In Acts 18:8, Crispus was another convert. It says, and all his house. In Acts 10:2, Cornelius, a devout man that feared God, he was converted. It says, and all his house. In John 4, verses 46 through 55, we read of the nobleman's son that was healed. It says he believed and all his house. Now, what I'm impressed with that is that here were people that had such an influence where somehow the respect, the honor that a household should have for their father or for their leaders in the home, it was so strong that when they converted, the influence was so strong that the whole house was converted. But it's just an example of how we as fathers should live such a life that has such an influence on our children, on those or anyone else in our household that's regularly under our direction, that when something like this happens, that they just follow. They have such a respect for that. In Psalms 103, I'm going to get a few verses of what God's intent is. In Psalms 103, verse 17. But the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting, upon him that fear him, and his righteousness unto children's children. To such as keep his covenant, and to those that remember his commandments to do them. It is God's will that the faith is passed on from John's generation to his children's generation, and their children instruct their children, and the faith is passed on from generation to generation to generation. And it says, to such as keep his covenants, and to those that remember his commandments to do them. That's the key. That we keep his covenants and remember to be obedient to his commandments. In Psalm 78, another verse. Verse 5 through 7. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children. So that's the will of God. It's passed from this generation to the next generation to the next generation, instead of generations arising that don't know God. I'm not exactly sure what happened in my mom's family that the six youngest all went out into the world. I don't know all those details. I don't know why. But that is not the will of God. Something was drastically missing. There may be a little bit of a clue. I'll just share this. My grandma,
would be my mom's mom, grew up in a drunkard's home. At the age of 15, my grandma was 15. At the age of 15, there were six children in the family. The youngest one was still sitting on the high chair to eat. And the mother finally had enough. She left. She deserted the home. She didn't come back for 18 years. She was out in the world for 18 years. My grandma was left with five children to take care of, a drunkard father, was 15 years old. And so she entered marriage with all that pain, all that difficulty. And the children sometimes brought it up to my grandma. You know, it started talking about the home. She just wept. She just cried. She couldn't talk much about her home. See, we don't know a lot about her, about her home. We just know that. But she just cried. And so I think that may be a little bit of a clue. If you enter marriage with a load of bondage, difficulty, and pain like that, it will hinder you from properly relating to your children. I just thought of that. That may be part of the reason. And Psalm 145 is another verse. Psalm 145, verse 4. One generation shall praise thy works to another and shall declare thy mighty acts. It's one generation. Your generation, Steve, you fathers, your generation, God wants you to tell your children about his mighty acts, the works he's done. And we just go, and this is sometimes I do this in my prayers as I'm praying to God. I go back, I remind God. Maybe there's something that I can hardly see my way through. I'm not sure how it's going to turn out. I like to go back. I like to remind God, Lord, you created heaven and earth. You delivered Israelites out of Egypt. You took them through the Red Sea, through the Jordan River, the walls of Jericho fell. If you could do that, you can do this too. Just a way to strengthen my faith in God, realizing the wonderful acts that he's done in the past. Another beautiful example we have is 2 Timothy 1, verses 4 and 5, about Timothy. Paul is commending Timothy about his faith. He said that faith first dwelt in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice. He says, I'm persuaded in you too. Timothy was a third generation. Now, Timothy had a Greek father. He had a Jewish mother, but he had a Greek father. So his father was not a believer. Somehow his grandmother and his mother had such an influence on him that he became an outstanding young Christian man. So now we're going to go to some of our responsibilities, and as far as relating to children, what God's will is for us. In Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 and 7, these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. What we're seeing here is what our responsibility is as a father to God's heritage. Let's remember that our children are God's heritage. And this is how God wants us to deal with our children, with his heritage. It says, and these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thinking about this, I had to think of our own home. Now, it says here, as you talk about them when thou sittest in thine house. We always had morning devotions. I don't ever remember. There may have been times that we skipped because something came up. But morning devotions usually consisted of, we go to the living room, we sit down, we had two songs. And Dad would read, he would read out of the scriptures, but he often read out of the Bible story book, Edgar Miles' Bible story book. He often read out of that. In the morning, we had a devotion to prepare us for the day. So when we sat in the house, our father was talking to us. When thou walkest by the way, we didn't spend a lot of time on on walks, anything like that. So I don't have any direct connection there. But and when thou liest down, I remember so well. It was. I had a sister that was older, my oldest sister, and she was the oldest of the family. There was five of us boys, and it's myself and my two younger brothers, just younger than me. I was probably eight. I was probably nine. I was eight when we moved to Canada. So this would be maybe nine, about 10, probably nine. My brothers were just, maybe one was seven, another one maybe six. We all slept in the same bed. But that is one of the best memories that I have of my father. When we'd go back to bed, he would come back to us and sit on the edge of the bed, tell us about the Bible story. That was just a very clear memory in my mind. It says here, when thou liest down, teach them about the word. Teach them about God, God's commandments, God's instructions. And he would often come back. He would ask, well, what story do you want tonight? Moses' story. And Dad said, we had that last night. We said, well, just to say it again. That was our favorite story. And so we heard that story a lot. And when thou risest up, take every opportunity as you go on walks, go outside, evenings, the stars, the moon, the clouds. There's a good friend of mine in Holmes County, Ohio. He was kind of a wild youth, and he got to the point where he hardly believed in God and so forth. He was like in his upper 20s, I think. He'd ride his motorcycle around. He got converted. He had long hair, shoulder-length hair. But he told me later, after he was converted, he told me what converted him, what convinced him that God was real. He said he was sitting out on his motor, he was riding his motorcycle one night, moonlit night. He just stopped. He sat on the bank of the road. And I just started looking at the moon. All of a sudden, I saw clouds living just moving past the moon. And he said, I started thinking, how's that possible? How's that possible? How does this work? Here we have a moonlit night and clouds are just gradually flowing by. God spoke to him through nature. He was converted. He gave his heart to the Lord. So we can take those opportunities and go out at nighttime and talk to our children about the stars. How God created the stars, how he created the moon, and just the birds. We had a service last evening, and Brother Freeman talked to us about the monarch butterfly. Well, I don't know how much you know about the monarch butterfly, but it's just amazing how God created the monarch butterflies. And as we take opportunity to explain these things to our children, it builds faith. But if we're too busy, if we have too many debts, we just got to work to get this done, we'll miss these opportunities. So I'm encouraging, if you have to cut something out, cut it out. Your children are God's heritage. They're not your own. They're His. It's our responsibility. And then even afterwards, supper time, we always sang two songs after supper. That was just the standard. Isaiah 28. Here we have some verses. Whom shall he teach knowledge? And whom shall he make to understand doctrine? Them that are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breast. For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little, and there a little. Now, fathers, don't get weary in well-doing. It takes persistence. Here a little. Here's an opportunity. Over here is an opportunity. A precept is a command or a rule of conduct. So here we teach a little bit. Here we have an opportunity. And we may think that our children caught the message. All of a sudden, we discover that they didn't quite get it the way we thought, and we just have to put another line on top of that. Another line on top of that. Here a little, and there a little. Precept upon precept. Just remember, Let's go back to our opening key verse. The Lord wants us to build his house, and we are laborers together with him. God has things he wants us to teach his children, his heritage, and we're just laboring along with him. Let's just keep that in mind. Ephesians 6:4, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. That word provoke means to anger. The Webster's Dictionary says to stir up some action or feeling to call forth with the voice. In Colossians 3:21, it says, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. They become disheartened. They become dismayed. They lose heart and so forth. The tone of voice gives a louder message to our children than actual words, and that's true. A little story that happened to a good friend of mine. He about angry and talking, how we talk to our children. His young daughter was three. A young daughter of three, and she was doing something, and he got kind of upset with her. And he spoke to her in a more of a strong, little bit harsher way. And then he noticed that she kind of realized it, and he realized he was angry. So he talked to his three-year-old daughter and asked her, do you sense that I'm angry? She says, yes, she senses that. He told her he's sorry. He repented of it. And he prayed. He prayed with her. He repented with her. And then he noticed that his two-year-old son was standing off to the side a little bit, and we were just watching. So he turned to his two-year-old son, and he said, asked his son if what he said. He asked his son, "Did you hear Daddy?" He said, "Did you hear Daddy?" He said, "Ooh," he said, "Daddy bass." Two-year-old son. He was just smitten in his heart. He brought his two-year-old son over to the son. He says, I'm sorry. Daddy was angry. He apologized to his two-year-old son. Prayed with him. There was a conversation between two fathers. And the one father was saying that you don't apologize to your children. That's weakness. The other father was saying, you do apologize to your children. That's strength. And it is. Your children, like this two-year-old son. This two-year-old son realized that dad was upset. His dad admitted it. He admitted his wrong to his two-year-old son and cleared that up with him. If he wouldn't have done that, his two-year-old son would have picked up. He'd been a little bit distant. Would have been given an opportunity to draw a little bit. Not quite sure daddy's safe. He may get angry at me. But by admitting it and clearing it up, clears the relationship. The Bible tells us that foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. He that spareth his rod hateth the son. He that loveth him chasteneth him betimes. Betimes means early or right away. If your children do need discipline, I know that this happens at times. Maybe children are naughty. The mom says, when daddy gets home, you're going to get a spanking. So the rest of the day, they're afraid of the daddy. It's a lot better. If mom can't take care of the situation, it's just better she just leaves it. Daddy comes home, she talks to daddy. Daddy goes to the child and starts asking questions and gets the child and do it that way. Don't produce fear in your children. Chasten thy son while there is hope, and let not thy soul spare for his much crying. I have a good friend that lives in Michigan, and I was talking with him probably about a year ago, and he was explaining to me, he grew up in a very authoritative home. His father was very, very strict. He was a disciplinarian. He was an angry, angry father. In fact, these boys, their father was such that if the boys, maybe three of the boys were out the barn, And they were didn't really have much to do. They were out in the barn, and they were doing something. Maybe it was a little bit before chore time and so forth. All of a sudden, one of them saw, "Daddy's coming." And they would all run. They would grab a hammer. They would beat on boards. And they would just let on. They were working. But Daddy would see that they were working. They were afraid to have Daddy come out and discover they were just visiting. They didn't have much to do. So that's wrong. That's totally wrong. Now this son is one of the younger sons of this father. And this is how he explained to me. This is how I'm just going to share what he shared, way that he disciplines his children. I thought it was very, very good. He said, "We have this certain room. It's a certain chair. That if my children, if they do something that they need a spanking for, all the children know that this is a place that it takes place. So I go in on that chair and I sit down on the chair. I take the child on my lap. And I talk to the child. Explain to the child what happened. So he explained it so that the child understands why the discipline. He doesn't discipline as long as the child is not willing to accept the discipline. Just kind of waits, keeps talking, asks him, are you willing? Do you understand what has happened? And once the child is willing, he gives them the spanking. But afterward, he holds the child again, talks with them, comforts them, assures the child that everything's fine. You're okay. You know, you're forgiven. Everything is clear. And then the child goes, and then he keeps observing the child. Maybe the child needs a second discipline for it, maybe later, whatever. But when he sees that this child is responding to the correction, as I take this child back in on that same chair, again take this child in my arms and say, "You know what, son? I see the grace of God is working in your life. God instructs us as fathers that we chasten your children for wrongdoing. That's what happened last week. That's what happened. Remember what happened? Yeah. But I see that is effective. That is taking... That the grace of he says that the grace of God is working in your life. You are growing in this area. I see progress." He affirms them that this is effective. You're doing well. He said it really works well. Children are secure, they're comfortable, they're secure. It just creates a very he has a good relationship with his children. I just thought that was a very, very good way to discipline children. One thing that I learned from our experience is that dinner tables, meal times should be happy times, where you sit down with your children and you visit, you talk. That's one of some of the good memories I have back at home. After supper, we would always sit there, sometimes even hour and a half, before we do the dishes, sit there and talk and visit. Of course, in Honduras, we had a lot to talk about. There was usually some kind of a robbery or some break-in or something here or something there that had happened. We had a store, and there was a lot of things that went on, so we had a lot to talk about. We just visited together as a family. But if Dad would have done a lot of correcting, a lot of reproving, a lot of admonishing at the supper table, we probably would not have had quite that relationship. Another thing that I learned in growing and for the children is, especially when they grow up, talk to your teenage children, plan with them. Don't just make plans and the children hardly know what's going on. Try to talk with the children. Make sure they're on board. Get their ideas. How would you do this? There's one father that, when his children were still going to school, he had his two oldest sons were his two oldest children were boys, and he said when he had a shop. He said if something would break down the shop, if he could make it due to the end of the day, till the children came home, He would wait to repair that piece of machinery until the boys came home from school, and they could do it together. He said that way the boys were learning repair, learning mechanics, and they talked. If they were talking, they'd talk a lot. And this same father had this practice that he told his sons, and this is something that's important. Sometimes maybe you're visiting with someone, maybe John and Benji here are visiting, and John's son there wants something with John. And so he just comes up, hey, Daddy, we need it. And now, wait a minute, we're talking. Okay. This particular father had an agreement with his sons. If he's talking with someone and they need something, just walk up and put their hand on his knee. If he's sitting, just put your hand on my knee. That way I know you need something. Then when I'm done and it's appropriate, that I'll ask you a question. They would patiently wait. It's just the way that he taught his sons to have respect and honor to elders. And if they did that to his father, they would do it to others too. Not putting the hand, but they would respect. What I'm talking about is the respect and honor. Teach your children to respect and honor elders and other people in those ways. Words of affirmation. This is something that I discover that in our Anabaptist circles, I believe this is something that we lack in. Giving our children affirmation. I'm going to give you two examples of our own experience. And I don't necessarily like to say this, but I'm just going to share it because we're just brothers together. We're just learning. We're just learning together. My oldest son, one time he had the power cart, our power unit, the horses, had a brush hog on it. He was out brush hogging way out back. And I had determined in my heart, I had determined that I'm never going to talk forcefully or derogatorily or rebuke my children in a way that I shouldn't rebuke my sons. Anyway, so he was out there brush hogging, and there was a lot of dead weeds on the cart and so forth, and somehow the battery chattered around, and it sparked and it caught fire. And all of a sudden this field was on fire. And the power cart burned off. It was a $3,000-$4,000 loss there, and we were in debt. We didn't have the money to replace that. And he was way out back, and he came running up, and we took shovels back, and we got everything under control, and everything was fine. And I never chewed him out. I didn't say any harsh words to him. We just talked. We just talked about it a little bit and so forth. Then later he was talking with my sister. He was complaining about that situation. He was just devastated. And my sister Barbara said, well, Dad didn't chew you out or anything, did he? And he said, no, but he didn't say anything. I did not affirm him. I did not tell him, son, it's okay. I'm glad you're safe. The horses are safe. You're safe. You're okay. I was struggling. Not against my son. I was struggling. How are we going to replace this thing? We don't have the money to replace this thing. I was looking at that loss. I wasn't mad at my son. I didn't even feel like, because I knew he felt bad about it. But I did not affirm him. Tell me, son, it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry about it. Somehow we can replace this. But son, I love you. It was an accident. It was not your fault. So we need to do that. We need to do those things. Somehow we. This is one reason I'm telling you that if there are things in your life that are not clear, clear it up. I had a lot of fear. There was a lot of fear in my life growing up. Certain things had happened that were out of my parents' control and so forth. And I had a lot of fear. And somehow I sensed that fear kept me from properly relating to my children, especially my son. Later, after I took care of those issues, and that issue was resolved in my heart, it changed. And I could relate to my children after that. So this is just take care of those things. I'm going to take Leonard Gunther. I was so blessed with Leonard Gunther down in Liberty, Kentucky one time. And they have, every once in a while, every year they have this community sale. And he was at this sale. He's bald, and he didn't have a hat on or anything, and he got burned. His head got burned. So he was there. We were there at his house after the sale, and he was, oh, my head hurts, and this is hot and all that. And he said, hey, Emily, why don't you get that lotion? Come over here and put that lotion on my head. And she did. Brought that lotion over and rubbed his head. And when she was done, he said, Emily, you're a fine daughter. That just really blessed me. He affirmed her. Okay, but there's a little catch. And it was fine. We do do that. But we usually do our affirmations after an act of well-doing. That creates performance. And we are kind of a performance-oriented, driven people. Because, you know, we teach our children to do right. That's right and good. We teach our children to do right. We bring them up, the nurture and admonition of the Lord, and they're taught to perform, but want to have it that they do that in the right direction. I would encourage you. I would do it weekly. Now, after my children are growing, I see this fault. And I would encourage you once a week, at least bi-weekly, take all of your children one by one. Maybe if you have five children, you could do it once a week. Take your child separate from the others. Assure them that you love them strictly because they are your son. God said, this is my beloved son whom I am well pleased. If we can assure our children that we love them, we accept them just the way they are, without any attachment, I think that would create secure, stable children that are not performance driven. If they only get affirmations when they do something right, they will do things just to get that affirmation. And I believe they should be affirmed without always having something attached to it. So I would just encourage that. Now I'm going to bring this to a close with one more scripture in Genesis 35. An account of Jacob. Jacob is going, if we read chapters 31, Jacob had such a, we know about his family situation. It was not a good family situation. By the way, something you should never do. Never show partiality in your family. Let me see, I think Jacob, Jacob did it. He showed partiality to his son Joseph. Made the brothers angry, and you know that whole story. But in chapter 31 of Genesis, we discover that Jacob sneaks away from Laban, and he takes his family. He sneaks away from Laban. He wants to go back to his father. Jacob pursues him, and they make peace, but their peace is not. If you compare the peace that Jacob made with Laban, and then later the peace he made with his brother Esau, it's different. The attitude is totally different. Jacob and Laban made peace. They made a heap, And they ate there together, but it was on a toleration basis. When it was with Esau, it was genuine. They loved each other. In chapter 32, Jacob wrestles with his angel all night long, wrestling with his angel. He says, I won't let you go until you bless me. I think God is dealing with Jacob. I think God is leading Jacob up to a certain point. In 33, we read how he meets Esau and they may make peace. And Jacob, just read that. How Jacob bows himself to Esau. And he says, thy servant. In fact, Jacob tells Esau, he says, I saw your face as the face of God. He just honored and respected. He held up his brother Esau. Chapter 34 of Genesis is kind of a dark chapter, where Dinah goes out to see the daughters of the land, and she's taken advantage of, and Simeon and the boys end up killing all those men in Shechem, and so that's kind of a dark chapter. But right after that, we come to chapter 35. This is what God tells Jacob, and I'd like to close with this account. And God said unto Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel, and dwell there, and make there an altar unto God that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau, thy brother. When Jacob fled Esau, and Esau was going to kill him, when Jacob went out, nighttime came, and he had that stone for his pillow, he had that dream, that ladder, that was Bethel. God tells him to go back to that place. Then Jacob said unto his household, and to all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you. Be clean, change your garments. Let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and was with me in the way which I went. And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of God. What we see here is God is calling Jacob to go back to Bethel and establish a true worship of God. But in order to do that, they had to get rid of all the strange gods, they had to get rid of all the earrings, they had to get rid of all the distractions that kept them from establishing a true worship of God. So that's kind of the challenge I would like to leave with us. Are we willing to get rid of all the distractions, all the things that hinder us from being co-laborers with God in teaching God's heritage the right way and establish true worship in our home? I would just like to leave that with us, and may God bless you, and I'll turn the time back over to Brother Steve.